We don't have a quorum, but the important people are here, so if you want to proceed, you may.
We're ready to vote.
Might die of a tie vote. Let's wait.
Well, we thought you'd be with us, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't know. I need more numbers to cover myself. Whoever's going to start, identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. We appreciate, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this opportunity to present to you the Minnesota Historical Society's 2012 capital budget request. I'd like briefly to describe the background of our requests and to talk about the Oliver Kelly Farm and Elk River, and then we'll conclude with our two other requests, historic sites, asset preservation, and the local historic preservations grants program. At its heart, the Minnesota Historical Society is an educational institution. In fact, one of the oldest in the state, with our founding in 1849 by the territorial legislature. This education work is valued by millions of all ages each year, from in-person visits to historic sites and museums across the state, and our ever-expanding work through online resources. An important component of this educational work, and the bulk of this capital budget request, is the Historic Sites Network, which was created in 1965 in state law. Care of these important places is a state responsibility. In bringing forward this request, we have two goals. First, to preserve our state's most significant historic resources so that they will be available for future generations, and, equally important, providing high-quality service to our visitors to help them learn about the past. This is not always the case, as you'll see in a moment, with the Oliver Kelly Farm request. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have brought forward three requests for this year's capital budget: historic sites asset preservation, revitalization of the Oliver H. Kelly Farm, and county and local historic preservation grants. So, what is the Oliver Kelly Farm and why is it important? The Kelly Farm is a part of the State Historic Sites Network and is one of just two dozen national historic landmarks in Minnesota. That's the highest designation given to historic places nationally. It merits this designation because it was the home of Oliver Kelly, the founder of America's Grange Movement. It's also a working farm near Elk River, and each year thousands of school children and families learn about agriculture through their visits to the Kelly Farm. And this, members of the committee, is one of the huge opportunities for the Kelly Farm. Minnesotans and our visitors from across the country and world learn about the importance of agriculture to Minnesota's economy. While we have been able to keep the historic buildings in good shape, our visitor center from the 1970s needs help. The building is an earth-sheltered structure with a leaky roof and is wholly inadequate in terms of classroom, restroom, orientation, and reception facilities for today's needs. Now I'd like to ask Bob Quist, who manages Oliver Kelly Farm, to describe some of the operational challenges we're facing there.
Mr. Quist, identify yourself for the tape and then continue.
Mr. Chair, Bob Quist, site manager for the Kelly Farm. The images they have in front of you really reflect parts of the Earth Sheltered Visitor Center. One of the challenges that we faced at the Kelly Farm is that the building was designed in the early 1970s and built before a program or a program thought was really came together. The challenges include a leaking roof, and it's an earth sheltered building, and when you have a leaky roof and it's an earth sheltered building, you remove the soil, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of it, twice. Our skylight has leaked since 1985 and has been repaired four times. For being an earth sheltered building, we have, I think, one of the most inefficient heating and cooling systems. It's always very warm in the summer and very cold in the winter. And as the building ages, The skylight windows continue to fail. We're at about 35% of those have failed so far. Mold damage and issues are growing as more water leaks through the underground membranes. And it's also been impossible to upgrade our facilities with telecommunications issues, in part due to the original construction. Everything we have is buried underneath the concrete in the building, and it's very hard to replace elements. The other thing we have, which is a challenge, it's in some ways a good challenge, is that overuse by increasing number of visitors stresses our capacity and is wearing our building away. We have one of our biggest challenges is to grow and educate our audience a sustainable number of people in a building that just wasn't designed for those numbers. Currently, we have to process over 300 students through a building in as little as 15 minutes. Now, how long does it take for 150 second graders to use the bathrooms after visiting a farm, after planting, gardening, pitching manure, and caring for animals? Especially if there's only two stools and one sink for each gender. At the same time, you have another 150 students that are ready to go use the restrooms after their hour-long bus ride. And they're all passing forward, and one of the challenges we have is because we see a lot of first, second, third, fourth graders, is to make sure that we don't have children from Andover getting on a bus to go to Hopkins again. And so part of what is that challenge is the building wasn't built for the audience size. The other component is that the Kelly Farm is a 189-acre working farm. We have no space to store or work on our farm equipment, both our modern equipment and our historic equipment. And we have no place at the inn for new animal arrivals, sick animals, quarantine animals. Our staff continues to change their clothing in the public restrooms, and we really don't have the infrastructure to meet even our current needs, much less to grow the new programs and audiences. A significant amount of our request is really to upgrade the facilities just to current needs. Revitalization will build on our current programs and the strength of that. It's going to give us spaces and tools to strengthen our assistants and teachers, helping them teach science, math, language arts, as well as social studies. Currently, almost half of our 12,000 students that come out in a year, the teachers use a Kelly Farm field trip for something other than just social studies. It is for math or science or language arts curriculum. Another component of new facilities and upgraded facilities is going to allow us to really create the platform for growing partnerships with other organizations and making our operations more sustainable in the long term. Last image, which is a little challenge to see, it just shows you that we draw, even though the Kelly Farm is located upriver, currently we draw from over 66 school districts across the state. 20 years ago, we had fewer schools, we had fewer students. If the weather turned bad, schools just didn't show up. Back then, we didn't schedule groups year-round because weather was so problematic. But we don't do that anymore. The demand from our school groups is too great, and the need to run an economically viable program requires year-round programming. Year-round programming requires facilities to meet those basic needs, and that's really what we're going towards with our new facilities.
The legislature has previously provided funding for schematic design, which has been completed. If this project were approved by the legislature, we would be ready to roll with construction in a number of months and certainly by the end of the calendar year. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in a year where you have many, many requests to fund, why fund this one? Just as the legislature will be providing funding for higher education facilities to ensure that our students receive a top-notch education, this facility will help students learn more about agriculture, one of the few thriving sectors of our state's economy. In a time when families have fewer personal connections to family farms, this provides an opportunity to for families to have a firsthand experience on a farm. Our agriculture sector needs smart, motivated workers who will help develop new processes and technology to make us more efficient to sell our products in the world economy. Who knows? That worker may receive his or her spark of inspiration on a visit to the Oliver Kelly Farm. This is a project that is familiar to the legislature. You approved the design appropriation in 2008 and approved construction funding in 2010. The good news is that we have an important state historic site with an exciting program that is highly attractive to schools and to families, and they're showing up in great numbers. We need to be able to accommodate them and to update and replace a very outdated and inadequate facility. We would appreciate your support for the completion of this project. I know it's in Mr. Hackbarth's, Representative Hackbarth's district, and sir, I didn't know if you wished to say anything or at this point.
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Historical Society for bringing this forward once again. Members, I've carried this legislation for a number of years, and I think this is the year that we can get this done. This is a very, very badly needed project, and I know a number of people have been on tours out to the facility. They've seen what the situation looks like out there, and it's long overdue that we get this done. I won't say any more on that. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. One moment, Representative Hausman. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. Representative Ward will move the minutes. I'm sure he's read them thoroughly. And they meet your approval, Representative Ward?
Absolutely.
All those in favor of the minutes as stated, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. And with this committee, I don't say in the beginning the clerk will take the roll. I believe the clerk is smart enough to figure that out without me telling her. So with that, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I agree with Representative Hackbarth.
Ooh, we got something going here. Mr. Elliott.
Thank you. If there are no other questions on Oliver Kelly Farm, then I'd like to briefly describe our request for historic sites asset preservation.
Mr. Elliott, yes, we do. Representative Kahn.
Sorry, I hate since we heard this yesterday and I made the same comments in state government finance, these guys are giving me dirty looks because they know what I'm going to say. And one of the things, but I actually think it's a principle that's important for this committee, is I think that we ought to ask projects like this, which are of a certain size, that they ought to make an attempt to find some private funding too, and that I think the project becomes much stronger when you're matching some chunk of public money to a chunk of private money. I think it becomes a stronger pitch for the state to do it, and I think it becomes a stronger pitch for the private for the private entities to say the state's doing this and we can go ahead if you match it. And they have, they think what they think is a perfectly good answer to that, and so I guess they might as well do it. But I'm just saying this is the first project that I've thought about it, for this one. And I'll give an example that I know, the one in my district, and again, I'll let them tell you what the difference is. The Mill City Museum is, I remembered how Dan McElroy was just ecstatic about how well the private match had done and how much private money. I think he was so ecstatic about it, he had the wrong amounts, but it was okay. I just think it works to promote it on both sides if we can do it. And I'm not convinced that this isn't one that it can be done for.
Mr. Elliott, would you like to comment on that?
Surely. Thanks for the opportunity. I think there are two elements here. One's a matter of public policy, and the other's a matter of practicality. This is a state historic site, and maintenance of state infrastructure is a responsibility of the state and has historically been handled through state bonding bills. We are responsible for 130 structures, many of them quite old, across the state. And if from a public policy point of view, we begin to be responsible for raising private money to maintain state infrastructure across the state and 130 structures, that is going to cannibalize the private fundraising that we do to maintain programs and operations, which is sorely needed considering the operating budget cuts that we've sustained over the years. And we've sustained them quite well. We've increased our efficiency. We're running the sites, and we're maintaining the other operations that we've been entrusted with. As state funding has been reduced and through a strengthened private fundraising program, it would be a shame to have maintained buildings not be able to be open to the public. I think from a public policy point of view, one has to ask why it's necessary to apply private fundraising to a capital need like this and not to some others, when it could do harm to the to programs and operations that make that asset usable to the public. From a practical point of view, we are constantly talking with friends and supporters about needs, and in this environment, there is less appetite for the support of a project like this. Until the state acts on the funding for this project, it's also a bit of a ghost project and hard to present to private donors for support. So it's here this project is sitting, you know, it's been kind of stalled in the front of the queue. We're a little concerned about delay of this and deferral and accumulation of major capital needs as other projects are in the back. And, you know, we would deeply appreciate the legislature's support for moving this much needed project forward this year so that we can go ahead with it and then begin to address other serious capital needs that are behind it.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect that the Historical Society does more private fundraising than just about any other state-related agency. I'm trying to think of any that would that significantly raise private money. I always think that we need to make decisions about where we use geo-bonding, where we spread the debt over a long term, and where we use cash. And if I had my druthers, if I were doing the budget for the Historical Society, I would much rather use all that private cash that's raised to hold down ticket prices so that more people can afford to go to those centers. And I think that would be the argument I would make about where do you put it? Do you put it in capital that you could spread over time, or do you use it in a really significant way helping the broad public, and that is to hold down ticket prices?
Mr. Elliott. Did you want to respond to that, or I have more hands that have been
raised?
I would
just say what she said. I wish I'd said.
Okay. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I have a question. A few years ago, we had a site visit out at Fort Snelling, and the visitor center out there had a lot of the same issues with water leakage and so on. Were these the only two facilities that were built that way, or are there others that are around the state? I've been to a lot of your sites, but obviously not all of them.
Do we have any other? I think those are the main.
Mr. Elliott.
And actually, that's the next looming major capital need behind this one that we need to address, and one reason why we'd like to get this one checked off.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear when you say the next. You mean the Forts?
The Fort Snelling.
Fort Snelling one
we
would
look
be
at
next
the,
after this.
Right.
But. Okay, but those are the only two then that were...
That I think are of that age and of that design.
Of that design that... okay, that's... Thank you.
Yes. Representative Kahn.
Well, I just want... Any of us who have done political fundraising know that the... Or who start with the base of political fundraising and then may need to raise money for something else like children in Africa or something like that, know that the first principles of that is that you don't go and find new people, you go to the people who have given to you before, and that they're likely to give it to you again, particularly if there's a new twist on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I certainly agree with what people have said about the success of what the Historical Society does in support, but I'm just saying it's my opinion, and in trying to do things, that the argument of there is a match is a very potent argument on both sides. It's potent for the state and it's potent for the donors.
I hear you, and
Mr.
I respect
Elliott.
That.
Okay, Mr. Elliott, continue.
Then to continue to describe our request for historic sites asset preservation, our overarching goal is to preserve Minnesota's most significant historical structures for the educational benefits of future generations. As I mentioned before, we're responsible for over 130 structures across the state, and by their very nature, many of them are old. On this slide and in your folders are a list of the specific elements of our asset preservation request. We have two statewide projects in which we will work on HVAC and energy efficiency projects, and a project to address masonry at various historic structures around the state. In the printout of the presentation, you can see the remaining specific projects prioritized in our asset preservation request. Each of these projects involve preservation of an important historic structure, which requires specialized architectural expertise. We thought you might enjoy seeing an example of the importance of this work firsthand. Several years ago, we addressed some roofing issues at the James J. Hill House, and David, since you're more familiar with it, this is David Kelleher. Perhaps David could describe what we've brought here.
Identify yourself with the tape and then go.
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. As Mr. Elliott just mentioned, a few years ago with asset preservation dollars, we repaired the roof of the Hill House, and as you can imagine, that was quite a big job. And in the process of doing that work, the workers who were working on that found what remained of the support system for the roof, and that was this piece of metal. What they replaced it with was this. This is what it would have looked like 100 years ago. This is what was left. And you can see the boring holes that replace it. We can pass this around.
So this is a good illustration of the nature of our challenges and why we like to keep addressing them as the need is there. And we would be happy to discuss any of the individual projects on the list if you have any questions.
Yeah, Mr. Elliott, I lost it here. The Fort Snelling.
Yes, sir.
Are those the old officers' quarters, the three or four square brick buildings right on the river block?
Yeah, we essentially have three challenges at Fort Snelling that we're working on. The first is not a capital project. It's really addressing what are the important historical themes to present at Fort Snelling, and what is the visitor experience that we want the outcome to be. Second is to address the visitor center issue. The visitor center is a failing structure and is not working well for its purposes and needs to be replaced.
Okay, and then and it's the visitor center. It's not.
And the third issue are the four historical structures on the lower post that are the society's and the state's responsibility and that are currently vacant and mothballed.
And they're the ones by the ball fields and the soccer fields, correct?
No, they're not up where the ball fields and soccer field. They're on the other side of the road from the ball fields and soccer fields.
Well, they're on the other side of the road, but they're by there, correct?
I guess it depends on your definition of by there. They're on the visitor center and Fort Snelling side.
So, Mr. Elliott, you have nothing to do with the other ones that are east of the ball fields?
Correct. Right. We do not have responsibility for the upper post.
That's simply the DNR?
Correct.
Now, is the land that where you have the buildings that you control different from the ones that the DNR controls, whereas the federal government actually owns the ones the DNR controls, but the DNR gets them for, I think, a free lease or something for 100 years. Are they different than that?
Let me defer to David on that.
But Mr. Chair, I think I can clarify that. The sort of eastern side of Highway 55, what we call the lower post, is all of the land is owned by the state of Minnesota. The historic site, the historic fort, and then the two barracks buildings and then the barns are under the control and administration of the Minnesota Historical Society. And the other side of the highway is under the control of the DNR. All the property is owned by the state of Minnesota. Some of the property on the other side of Bloomington Ave is owned by different agencies of the federal government, the Veterans Administration, GSA, but on the river side, if you will, of the highway, the historic fort is what we have responsibility for. And there are a couple of elements in this request up on the screen right now. Building 22, which is the small building next to the visitor center, and then building 17 and 18, the cavalry barracks that are next to the visitor center as well, the red roof buildings that you see on your way over to the airport from St. Paul.
Yeah, one last question. Do you oversee Whiskey's Grave also?
That's near the historic site, correct. So that's okay. In between the what we call the mule barn and the visitor center, yes.
Okay. Proceed.
Any other questions on asset preservation? Then finally, our third area is the County and Local Historic Preservation Grants. This is a program that's been in virtually every capital budget bill since 1994. This program provides funding to cities and counties to preserve their most significant historic properties. It's a competitive grant program that has helped communities across the state, I think is highly valued by communities across the state, and it requires a match. And if there are no questions on that.
I would have one question on that.
Yes, sir.
We have a member that's introduced a bill several years in a row, and I hope I get this correct. The Potter's Sheet Music Museum, am I saying that correctly? It's supposed to be a historical building. Well, it's Representative David's bill, and he's gone through the Heritage Fund. He's been in the Capital Investment Committee. Would that qualify under some local or county historical grant process?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to recall I think you've described two different projects there that are in that same community, but I can tell you in general terms what would qualify. Buildings that are on the National Register of Historic Places, which have gone through a review process, and projects that are ready to go with the match, with a good application. Generally, with the amount of money that you all have appropriated over the years, the grants range from $75,000 to $200,000. So if that project is looking for significantly more money, then obviously there wouldn't be funding available given the limits under this grant program.
Well, Mr. Kelleher, if we, let's say we did something different and we put more money in that fund, would that allow projects like that to come to you for a grant rather than coming to this committee for capital investment?
Mr. Chair, that would certainly be possible, and we'd be happy to use the same kind of criteria that we have over the past 15 years that we have for this program, National Register buildings and all the other criteria that's required of bond-funded projects.
Then, Mr. Kelleher, if it was done that way, would you not agree it would be less political and those of us elected here wouldn't be hand-picking the projects that are taken care of under that program?
Mr. Chair, what we've done since 94 is run a competitive grant program, and the projects that come in apply on their merits, and the Grants Review Committee and the staff review those projects and check for their readiness for construction and fulfilling historic preservation standards.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I just know something about the psychology of us, though. We don't tend to be very generous about those pots of money when we don't know the particulars about what it's going to. The point you raise, I can think of, just without much effort, a number of theaters of historic significance. I mean, the Chatfield one is one of those that has a long history to it, that theater, and who's been brought on that stage. Representative Erdahl has one. Is his in Litchfield? I'm not altogether sure. That has significant history behind it. And Duluth has one that they're worried about. So that idea of old historic theaters that have quite a great past are significant, the stories they tell. But we just never get very generous at those pots of money, those funds, when we don't know how it's going to be used. That's the downside, given the size of those projects.
I just think sometimes it would be better than that other folks pick and choose who gets the money. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when you brought it up, and maybe the staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection, because we did do a site visit there where there were two separate projects, and the theater is actually part of the local school building. It's a wing on it, if I recall, and then there's a long history of the theater part of that school. The other, when you referenced the sheet music, I don't think the building in and of itself was historic. It was the sheet music that it contained, which is a reservoir of very unique sheet music that's used worldwide, if I recall our testimony when we were down there. But they did need a better facility to protect it, better environmental controls and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to separate the fact that it was to protect historic documents, let me put it that way, versus an historic building.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like you've done a really good job of making the grants statewide, of awarding the grants statewide. You know, I think if I'm looking at Aiken County, I don't see anything in Aiken County. And there's some other counties I don't see any awards on. But can you just kind of give us a quick review of the specific criteria? Do you actually look at previous grants awarded in different areas and take that in consideration, or as you, Mr. Keller said, they're based on their merit? What's their merit? I mean, can you give us kind of some criteria that you use,
Mr. Keller,
in the selection?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, we look at what comes in, and as I mentioned before, the most important criteria is since this is for historic structures, it's buildings that are on the National Register of Historic Places that need help for preservation. We try to, as you mentioned, look statewide to make sure that there's a statewide distribution of these funds so that there's some fairness. If there's a particular county that's missing, it's probably because no one's applied from that county. We have a field services staff that travels around the state that gives advice to county historical societies and cities and counties on how to run historic programs and how to preserve historic structures, and they're happy to talk to anyone in all 87 counties who want to apply for grants. So the basic criteria is historic structures and readiness to do the project to have a successful project.
Thank you.
Representative Grzeskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, have you talked to or have you looked at using some of the legacy dollars for these projects? Has that been considered? We are collecting $280 million a year from the taxpayers of Minnesota for a portion of that. I believe $54 or $55 million a year is for the category that are arts and history. I'm curious of what you've done to consider those funding sources for these projects.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm relatively new, but I'd like to take a first stab at it and then let the veteran chip in. And that is that the major capital projects and the asset preservation are needs that have been historically funded in the state's bonding bills, and therefore it would not be legal. It would not be in accordance with the letter and spirit of the legacy bill to supplant that funding and now draw those funds from legacy funding.
Representative Grzeskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't know if that really has been established yet, so it's interesting to hear that. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well,
Representative Grzeskowski and Mr. Elliott, my opinion would be that you historically have gotten it from capital investment because there wasn't a constitutional amendment or a heritage fund or anything of that nature. And I think to better use the word supplant, you'd almost have to have a statutory fund going in constantly, at least more constant than capital investment. By no means is historically constant. It could go just about any direction or get vetoed 3 years in a row and then get something and then get vetoed the next year. So I think Representative Grzeskowski raises a good point with that. Maybe you could do a little checking on that. Mr. Anderson, did you want to chime in on that? Kelleher?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add is the language in the Constitution refers to traditional sources of funding rather than traditional amounts of funding. So the traditional sources refers to just that, the source, the place where the money comes from. And the source for, as Mr. Elliott said, for betterment of historic sites that are a state responsibility in the State Historic Sites Network has been the capital budget. That's the traditional place or source where the dollars have come from. And I understand what you're saying about different levels of funding. They've gone up and down. Certainly, they do go up and down, but it doesn't say levels or amounts in the constitutional language.
Representative Fabian, or Representative Grzeskowski first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that not only are the projects ad hoc, but the bonding process is ad hoc. So I don't understand how either one of them can be construed as regular, normal funding stream or source when the decisions around those are ad hoc each time. I fail to see how that fits.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to follow up a little bit, too, on the traditional funding. If we go back to when the legacy amendment was passed in 2008, I believe, it was before I was here, those entities that are now receiving funds from that, where did they traditionally get their funding from? And I think that that's a valuable discussion to have in this committee.
Representative Lanning, and then we're going to try to move on.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the way I would look at traditional sources is things that have been in our budget from year to year. I look at capital investment dollars as one-time dollars. And just because some project or some proposal has gotten funding one year doesn't in any way, shape, or form mean it's going to get funding in any subsequent year. The decisions we make on bonding are one-time decisions. And, yeah, you can go back and say that historically we've provided funding in numerous years for various things. But I don't think you can call that traditional in the sense that you can with budget dollars. And I understand there's a difference of opinion with regard to this, but I have a real hard time with some people who take an extreme view of what legacy can or can't be used for. And I don't think you can make a legitimate argument that using legacy dollars is somehow supplanting what traditionally has been provided. So the argument lives on, I guess.
Mr. Elliott, why don't you continue with your presentation unless you're done?
We've completed our presentation, and we're very grateful to you all for your time and your attention and for your good questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Kelleher, I'm sorry about the mistake. I was thinking about the former speaker when I started to address you, and it just slipped out. Public safety.
Thank you.
You know, I should just go.
Are the folks from Public Safety ready for their presentation?
We are ready.
All right, very well. Go ahead and proceed, and please give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Eide, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management within the Department of Public Safety. With me today is Deputy Director Joe Kelly, who is our Deputy Director and has been working on this State Emergency Operations Project. We're here today to present our one and only bonding request from the Department of Public Safety for the State Emergency Operations Center. The project scope is to request $26 million for a state-of-the-art State Emergency Operations Center. A State Emergency Operations Center is where state agencies, the federal government, and some local county officials and the private sector come together to coordinate activities to support local government when we have emergencies and disasters. The State Emergency Operations Center in Minnesota has been activated was activated 92 days in 2009 and 10, activated for 45 days in 2011. And so far in 2012, we've actually been activated one day for an alert condition at the Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant. The state agencies send their staff to that facility to coordinate all the activities surrounding the support of local emergencies during that time. This project will also be the permanent offices for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We currently have 75 full-time employees, and this location would also possibly co-locate two other DPS functions, and that would be the Minnesota Duty Officer Program and the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. Typically, the State Emergency Operations Center is activated for natural disasters. However, in this day and age, we do have to make sure that that we are available and ready and prepared to respond to environmental issues, to acts of terrorism, to health pandemics, and to also prepare for special events that may be of national security in scope. As I said, the role of a state emergency operations center is to coordinate the state response. It's to communicate with local emergency operations centers, the incident commander on scene, and the federal government. We act as that liaison. We provide support to the scene. Support could be different types of resources, including human capital and equipment to the scene. And we coordinate the public information, which is one of the very most important things that we as the state of Minnesota does. We can meet with the media all at one time. We speak with one voice. We have representatives from local government there that also will share the information so that we all know that our public message is coordinated and we do not confuse the victims and the survivors of disaster. The characteristics of a state emergency operations center are five: survivability, security, sustainability, interoperability, and flexibility. These are the core capabilities that are the standards of the Department of Homeland Security. Currently, our facility fails in all five of these areas. We have had several assessments, both done post 9/11, one conducted by a special team from the National Guard, and one conducted during an accreditation visit by an independent accrediting body. Per Homeland Security requirements, each state must have a primary and an alternate emergency operations center to act as the state's command center. Our current location and our facility is in the middle of downtown. It does not meet these core capabilities for Homeland Security purposes. Many of the new EOCs that are being built, this is not unique to Minnesota. Most of our state emergency operations centers were in basements of capitals. So about the late 90s, when the federal government really started to think about acts of terrorism after the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, we were all told to move out of the state capitals. So some of us moved into other buildings. Some of us, like us, moved into leased space close to the Capitol complex. Now the trend is to move away from Capitol complex because that is a target, and we have to make sure that we do have a facility that we can manage those kinds of disasters. So we are one of many states that are going to their state capital investment committees to ask for funding, and ours being a medium state is right about in the middle third of those requests. So here I want to share with you just some of our shortfalls of survivability. Survivability obviously means that if something happens, your building can survive. Which means that you can't be in a high-risk area. As I said, we are in the middle of downtown. These photos are actually outside our side door, outside our front door, and straight up from our front door. We're adjacent to high-rises. Requirements are that you be 10 feet away from every story of a building that is adjacent to you. We are right in the middle of several high-rises. We're also in a high traffic area, and now about 10 feet from our front door is the light rail. So we definitely are in a vulnerable location. Some of our vulnerabilities of security. We are above ground, and there, even though it is recommended that part of your facility be underground, there really is no longer the bunker mentality. But there's a lot of hardening that can be done that's a lot more cost effective than digging deep into the ground and creating a bunker atmosphere. We have direct entry. Again, these photos are of the fact that we are on top of a parking ramp. We are next to a very high crime bus stop, and our back door opens up to the street. Sustainability in this case means that your staff is able to work there for a protracted period of time. It's very difficult to do with leased space. We don't have the areas that we could bunk. We don't have a mess hall or a kitchen or anything like that where we could take care of our needs. The landlord controls the HVAC system, so that at 5 o'clock every day and on weekends, the ventilation is turned off. So then, when we turn on, we have to make sure that we get that taken care of, and then we bear the cost of the entire building because our area is not sectioned off. So in that same vein, there is no air filtration if it was some kind of a chemical incident that was happening in downtown St. Paul. We only have one telecom entrance, so there is not the redundancy that is required from having a couple of different ways of getting telecom in there. And we have weekday-only food service. We do have catering contracts that we have for weekends, and that is a little bit more expensive than it is if we were to have our own food service in our building. And some of the interoperability. As you know, you have also been very generous with the armor system over the past few years. And the interoperability really means that we have to be able to communicate across the whole state amongst all the disciplines. We are in a communication dead spot. We must then relay to the DOT building and then re-repeat from the DOT building. We had to get special antennas, and we pay for leased space on the roof to have some antennas on the roof of our building. Some of the flexibility, we want to be able to be flexible with this space and be able to use it for a lot of training while we are activated, because we do activate quite often during the year. But our current space just really is inadequate space for us to share for a lot of the training and the conference space that we need in our kind of business. And this is a photo from our front door onto our street during the Republican National Convention in 2008. So as you can see, we are in a vulnerable position. We could smell the smoke bombs. People were banging on our windows that they knew we were in there, so let them in. So we were not in the optimal position for that event. And speaking of vulnerability, I'm going to show you in a couple minutes the cost, a little bit of the cost breakout from our pre-design. This is the Tuscaloosa, Alabama Emergency Operations Center and Public Safety Building. This is a brand new building. They chose not to harden this facility because it was not in a high-risk area. It was not in a vulnerable area. But obviously, you can see a direct hit from an EF3 tornado completely took out their emergency operations center, took out their police department, and their dispatch center. So imagine having something happen. You get to your emergency operations center, and it's completely unusable because we chose not to harden the facility that is what they had to deal with. So our current status, our pre-design, in the governor's 2010 recommendations for the bonding bill, the pre-design for $2.25 million was in the governor's recommendation, and the legislature passed that bill with the caveat that we conduct a traffic study for the Arden Hills facility. So we conducted that traffic study. We did a pre-design with all the stakeholder groups that are in the Emergency Operations Center, stakeholder groups from local government that utilize our services during emergencies and disasters, and we came up with our space plan. We've received the required recommendations from the House Ways and Means and the Senate Finance Committees, and we have selected our construction manager if we receive the approval for construction money. The pre-design ended with a 52,200 square foot building. And as I said, this is right about in the middle third of the state emergency operations centers that have been built recently or are currently being built. It requires 15 to 20 acres, which is up at the Arden Hills Army training site. We need parking for 180 cars, which are part of that 15 to 20 acres. We need to have controlled access, so that has been designed into it. We are hardening our mission-critical areas. We must have a robust technology and audio-visual capability within an emergency operations center. One of our design firms said that really an EOC is information technology with a building wrapped around it, and that's kind of the way it is. We have designed the redundant power and communication systems in here. So when all of our folks got together, we didn't end up with a 52,000 square foot building. We ended up with about a 65,000 square foot building. So we looked at the space plan, and we looked at the facilities that the Army National Guard was building on the Arden Hills Army training site. And we were able to reduce our plan by about 13,000 square feet by being able to leverage some of the facilities that will exist or already exist within the AHATS area, and that be the heated storage for some of our equipment. We also have large vehicles, so vehicle storage for those, a mess hall kind of a place, a commercial kitchen. A workout center, because one of the things for survivability that we really need to do is take care of responders who are going to be there. I have been part of an emergency operation that went over last Thanksgiving and last Christmas, sleeping on blow-up mattresses and eating heater meals is not the way to actually spend your Thanksgiving. But one of the ways that we want to make sure is that we take care of our workers, and so we do have to have some way to work out, but we know that those facilities exist on the Arden Hills site. And, of course, some showers also for our staff for long term. So our total request is $26 million. Of this, the building itself is $8.5 million. That gets you the Tuscaloosa, Alabama model. The sustainability for the type of runoff and to meet all the requirements of the Department of Administration and their environmental requirements, it adds another $700,000. The hardening and redundancy is where we really look at the increased cost. And there are several levels, and we have done a hybrid. So we have not hardened 100% of the facility, but we have hardened the areas that are not protected. That added another $10,300,000. The technology and the audiovisual plan adds about $3.5 million, and then the miscellaneous construction-related costs, including inflation, is about $3 million for the total of $26 million. And so here's really kind of a space plan. Now, this is not the design. Our construction documents are not completed yet. But this is the space plan, so you can see the type of area that will be our core services, the State Emergency Operations Center main floor, where the state agencies work, our offices, the Joint Information Center that it's going to double as a training room, and all the parking and the runoff area that we need in our 15 to 20 acres. The impact of not funding this is that we will continue to have the risks posed by the location of our facility, and we'll continue to not meet federal requirements. But one of the main impacts of not funding is we will have to decide what we need to do when our lease runs out. We currently pay little less than $1 million in a biennium for rent. So $1 million going to somebody else to rent a facility that doesn't meet the federal requirements, and we will continue to have to do that. So when our lease is up in a few years, we will still have to decide what it is that we're going to do for our State Emergency Operations Center.
Ms. Ide, if I could interrupt you for one moment. Representative Carlson, I believe, has a question.
As soon as she's done.
Okay, very fine.
She looks like she's
and
we're
almost done.
I happen to be done.
Oh, very good. All right.
Representative. Time.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to, I guess this is going to be the third time that I've referenced site visits, but I'm just trying to get a handle on these facilities and what the relationship is. The chair and I and Representative Mullery, after the tornado hit parts of Golden Valley in my district and then went through North Minneapolis, we did a site visit up in Fridley. And there was that emergency response system there. I think the person that was in charge at the time was the former fire chief of Minneapolis. But what is the relationship to your agency and what they do? And then speaking of site visits, another place we went with the Capital Investment Committee was the tower in Golden Valley that provides for emergency and dispensing of information, as I understand it, that needs to be replaced. So how does all of that come together, you know, where we've got that very sophisticated Fridley location with what you're talking about? And then I've got a follow-up question or two.
Ms. Ide.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the relationship is that every community and every state has to have one primary and one alternate emergency operations center. So the site in Fridley is Minneapolis's emergency operations and training facility. It is also their information gathering area for their Minneapolis PD. When an incident happens, as the North Minneapolis tornado, we at the state activate the state EOC, and Minneapolis activates their EOC, and Hennepin County activated their EOC. So everybody has their roles of providing assistance and providing resources and coordinating, and we are then the conduit to the federal government. So we have liaisons in their emergency operations center, both in Hennepin County and in Minneapolis, so that we kind of have eyes and ears on the ground. And we are, our health department is working with local public health in that emergency operations center. So it's a whole different layer, but the same kind of responsibility. Ours is just a complete oversight from a statewide perspective. So if that tornado had started in Carver County and came all the way through, we would be working with the priorities and the resources and the assistance to the entire disaster site and not just Minneapolis. But they do the same thing at the city level that we do. Now, the building in Golden Valley, I believe you're talking about, is the 911 public safety answering point for Hennepin County.
Yeah, but Madam Chair, we did learn when we were there that it's not just Hennepin County. It provides surface service heavily to southwestern Minnesota, if I recall, for maybe it's a contractual arrangement or it goes far beyond Hennepin County at any rate.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I'm not sure what they provide. That is really a dispatch service under the sheriff's office. So that's not their emergency operations center.
Okay. And
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, then your last point there was $3 million in terms of site preparation, and did you indicate that part of that was for cleanup then?
There is a tiny little bit for cleanup, but since it is the responsibility of the federal government to clean up, we are working with the National Guard, with the federal contractor for cleaning up the sites.
Representative Carlson?
Well, what I was trying to, when the reference to the cleanup, Madam Chair, was, you know, there's been some discussion about, at least earlier, stadium site there, and one of the big cost items was cleanup, but I think the question was answered then when you say the site you're looking at would be taken care of by the federal government, where the other site, I think, is now either owned or would be owned by Ramsey County if the stadium were built there. And
Madam Chair,
then I think the cleanup must be shifting to who has to pay for it if that's the case.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those who are new on the committee, this is one of those projects we've been dragging our feet about a lot of years, and she's been trying to convince us for a lot of years. And I think because there are really numbers of questions around it, and when you look at the characteristics, of course, they all make perfect sense. And then you look at the next few pages, and one wonders, why did we choose this to begin with? Because those seem, for an emergency center, not surprising. I mean, you could have had those same characteristics before 9/11, survivability, security, sustainability. So maybe it predates the two of you, and you don't have any insight about why we initially did this. First question, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, we did not actually pick that site. In about 1997, the great floods of the Red River in 1997, we were actually in the Capitol. And at that point, we knew that the Capitol was not adequate to take care of the response to the Red River Valley floods at that point. So we actually moved into the fifth floor of the Veterans Affairs Building. It was at that same time that the Department of Public Safety was looking at building a building. They did not receive the bonding money. We had to move out of the DOT building and the Capitol building, and it was determined that all of public safety would be together, including our Emergency Operations Center. So we were making a silk purse at that point.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Hausman.
I mean, obviously, the underlying question is here: how does a state best respond to a disaster, and what should be in place? And of your characteristics, when you talk about interoperability, my understanding is at 9/11, what they realized is the emergency personnel could not speak to one another, and so there were firemen in that building who didn't come out. Because the police or whatever couldn't talk to them. My understanding, so now we've gone to war, we've done airport security, and my understanding is we still haven't accomplished that all emergency people can speak to one another. I mean, that I could be wrong, but that's my understanding. That. So to me, I mean, if you just said what is the absolute first thing, you don't do anything else until you do, that you would do that. I sort of recall that maybe we asked you to do that traffic study because we don't want to make a mistake again. And as we looked at that site, the new site, just looking at a map of highways, it didn't feel right. And I just looked through here to see if there was an overhead so that we could see it now. You know, how do highways interrelate to that? And whether the traffic study was it for that purpose? And I would love to see that traffic study, how it proved that is absolutely the best site that you've determined that. How did you come to that realization? I don't think we can really understand that without a map. But then to Representative Carlson's point, the Fridley site. I think a lot of things happened right after the 35W disaster. My understanding is that as people thought about it, things happened pretty quickly, and so there were some things that happened right. And since Minneapolis and Hennepin County certainly are the biggest players in this state, hopefully there's been significant conversation about joint ventures. If we're building state-of-the-art in Fridley, how might we build on that, since it is right here in the metropolitan area, right in the heart of where the major population lives. This Golden Valley site, the bonding request, I don't know if it's going to be funded or whether it's even the governor's bill, but my understanding is they're contemplating a move to Plymouth, so that they're moving out of the Golden Valley site to Plymouth. So there's other major work going on about emergency centers, and somehow I wish all of those players sat in a room and with a map and made some determinations that we can honestly say we're putting everything in the right place and we're not duplicating expensive. This is expensive when you talk about just that one item. What do you call it? Hardening. That's a big price tag. Are we going to have hardening of buildings in several places? And so the struggle with wanting to get this right is, I think, part of what I bring to the...
Director Eide, I just want to hop in here for a second. Can you address her first issue, Representative Hausman's first issue of, are all these law enforcement and emergency management, all these personnel that we kind of, you know, what we learned from 9/11 was that they were unable to communicate with each other. Are we better there? Are we better off? Are we doing that now? Are there still some things that we need to accomplish in that area?
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, we are a great way down that road in interoperability. I believe we are about 75% built out in the armor system. This is more in the realm of the division of emergency networks, communication networks in the Department of Public Safety, and I'm sure that she can give you a whole lot better answers than I can. But there's been almost all the counties, with the exception of the northwest portion, have chosen to go on to the armor system. The towers are built. The backbone is ready. The radios have all been, a lot of the radios have been ordered. And so we are a leader in the United States on interoperability.
That's good to hear. Representative Hausman, did you have a follow-up or...
Unless they wanted to comment on any of the other.
I'd love to comment on the other. I am happy to get you a copy of the traffic study. We did three scenarios for the traffic study. One was, the reason that we asked about the traffic study was because the location is at the confluence, 35W and 694, and 10 in that area. And our traffic study looked at three scenarios. One was we took out the use of 35E for state agencies in particular to get to the Emergency Operations Center. The other was we took out both 35E and 694. And the third scenario was that there was a no-notice evacuation because of a Monticello nuclear power plant, and people in the Twin Cities did a panic evacuation, 694 to 35W North. So our engineering firm did those three scenarios and found that by using back roads, at the very most, it adds about 20 minutes in commute time to responders to get to that site. In addition, right at that site is a helipad. So if we needed to get people in emergency functions that we needed to get the governor there right away, we would have that opportunity to bring a helicopter from St. Paul into the area. As far as the Fridley site is, the missions of the Golden Valley and the Plymouth site is completely different from an emergency operations center. The mission is the same for for the Emergency Operations Center in Fridley. The city of Minneapolis owned that land, and that was why they built on that land. That land for State Emergency Operations Center is not adequate. So even if we were adjacent to that, it would not meet the requirements of a State Emergency Operations Center because it is on the river, it is across the road from a rail switching station. It is upwind, downwind from the wastewater treatment plant. So it would not meet our requirements at all. We feel that the Arden Hills Center being free land, having access from major roadway networks, and also being able to build in a secure environment is the best piece of property for us.
Good. Representative Ward, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Seide, I'm going to throw a bunch of cold water out here. Can you tell me, clear up my mind on this, has the site already been obtained? Has it been determined? Has it been solid, locked in?
The actual site on the property is will not be locked in until the Department of Administration has control of the piece of property from through congressional action from Congresswoman McCollum.
Madam Chair,
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So have there? And I understand the population of the state, you know, down here and. You know, a lot of protection of lots of important infrastructure here and things as such. Have any other sites statewide been looked at?
Director Eide.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, not as our primary, no.
Okay, what, are you wanting to put it in Bemidji?
Madam Chair, no. We've got a better place.
Okay, Representative Ward.
And it's not in my district, so this is not a, you know, this is not a personal suggestion, but, you know, I guess I look at Camp Ripley and what's being done at Camp Ripley and what we have invested in Camp Ripley in the, through bonding projects and training safety centers and miles and miles and miles of updated technology cable for broadband, for communications. I keep hearing the same things that, you know, that are problematic, that have been problematic, that we've addressed it at the Camp Ripley site. You know, they also have a Department of Transportation vehicle there. They have Department of Public Safety agency. They are collaborating right now. Mm-hmm. And they have, so my question would be, you know, could we, while we may not be in total agreement that, you know, this is even, I happen to believe that this is important and we need to be, I think, you know, proactive rather than be reactive, and especially in emergency kind of situations. We had that same discussion with the Department of Health the other day in AIG. But can we do it in a more effective and efficient? And we're always talking about shared services around here, and we're always talking about doing things more effectively and efficiently. We heard yesterday about, you know, borrowing, and you know, we do too much borrowing. But last budget, we borrowed money to balance the budget. So let's really. You know, put it on the line. Can't we look at a facility that has a lot of what you're already talking about, and invest in that, and it's centrally located in the state of Minnesota? Because sometimes we forget that, you know, maybe an emergency might happen in northern Minnesota or eastern Minnesota, or, you know, wherever. So response time may be better for other places in the state of Minnesota. So you understand what I'm saying? Can you address some of that concern?
Director Eide.
Madam Chair, I'm going to turn this over to our Deputy Director, Joe Kelly, who happens to be the retired Brigadier General for the Minnesota National Guard and was absolutely the best partner for the Camp Ripley activities that are going on.
Very good. Deputy Director, identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Joe Kelly, and I am the Deputy Director for Homeland Security and Emergency Management. So, Madam Chair, Representative Ward, thanks for bringing up Camp Ripley, because I think it is a wonderful success story of an interagency, interdepartmental, cooperative effort one of its the keystones of it is the Emergency Management Training Center, which was built with state capital dollars. That is a training center that will that is intended to train emergency management professionals and other responders to do exactly the types of things that we're talking about. The facility that we built up there is, however, at this point, is just a training center. It does not have the full functionality of an emergency operations center yet. That is a possibility for the future. My personal opinion, Representative, is that might be a good alternate state emergency operations center for the future. Our current alternate is in the New Brighton Public Safety Building. I think one of the challenges as we look at if we were to make that the primary state emergency operations center is that the people, the staff that populate the state emergency operations center during a disaster come from the state agencies, and they come from those agency offices and departments here in the metropolitan area. So that facility up there, in addition to being a great example of how departments are working together to make sure that they have the capability to do these types of things and sharing resources, is probably for the primary purpose for the State Emergency Operations Center too far from the state agencies that send the staff to it. But it's a great opportunity for future.
Well, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I heard you say is that we can move all the state agencies to Brainerd so that they'll be closer. So that would be terrific. Then I appreciate that.
Any other questions from our members? Well, thank you. Oh, Representative Clark.
Thank you. When you're talking about the hardening of the facilities, you're talking mostly about physical hardening, I take it?
Director Eide.
Yes, we are.
I'm wondering if you could just maybe briefly describe what that is. I was trying to look at the schematic, and does that mean putting some things underground, or is it, well, what does it mean?
Director Eide. Or, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to
Deputy Director Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I had the very same question when we worked on this project in the pre-design phase. And what they mean when they say hardening, they are looking primarily at a monolithic, if you will, poured concrete structure. So instead of being steel beams or masonry block, it's a cast concrete structure. And as the Director Eide said earlier, as we tried to come up with a reasonable cost for this, we looked at hardening only the mission critical facility. So picture a poured concrete facility for the core of the state of this building.
Representative Clark,
thank you, Madam Chair. Does that mean that some some of it is underground or not?
We have not yet. Madam Chair, Representative, we have not yet got to that point. That is an option, as the director mentioned, that we could put some of this underground, or that will come out of the design process when we do soil testing and the rest of that. But that certainly is an option, Representative. And as the director said, that's often a good way to provide some of that protection.
Oh, thank you. I guess I missed that.
Representative Clark.
One other question then. What about the hardening of the communication facilities? I know hacking into communications, that's a certain kind of terrorism that's going on now. What is that? Do you look at talk about hardening of the communication system?
Deputy Director Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, we of course will fall under the Minnesota Office of Enterprise Technology for cyber security. When we talk about hardening and redundancy from the standpoint of communications, whether it's voice or telephony, those types of things, we're talking about redundant systems, having more than one source, more than one feed come in. But certainly we will apply the latest information technology security to this to prevent hacking or other cyber intrusions. But what's talked about there mostly is having more than one source for both power and for technology coming in the building, so that if that circuit is lost, if that communications line is cut, we can roll over to the other feed.
Representative Clark?
Well, just one final thing with that. I do understand having, you know, a backup communication system, but I guess I was asking about, you know, the security of the systems itself and what we hear a lot about these days about those being compromised.
Deputy Director.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do believe if you're talking about the physical protection of those communications cables, the plan did include them to be placed in security conduit, if you will, so they couldn't be physically hacked into. But from a virtual standpoint, again, I would say that we're just going to fall in with the latest information technology security. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Well, I guess I think you're telling me that you have considered that in some way. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions, members? If not, thank you so much for your testimony. Very informational. And I'm sorry, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to, after, if we're done with this item, I wanted to talk about another item. If I could,
okay,
Mr.
sure.
Manager.
All right, sounds good. Thank you again. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Madam Chair, I passed around a graph back to our discussion from yesterday, and Madam Chair, I would hope that in the future we have some more detailed discussion about this and maybe bring forward some additional resources. I'd like to thank Ms. Johnson for her help in pulling this together from House Research, but this is a graph of the per capita net general obligation debt that we have here, actually demonstrated through the bars on the graph, and the line is the ratio of debt to personal income. So first one is the per capita, help me out here, per capita net debt to personal income, and the line is ratio of net debt to personal income. Both of them are increasing substantially. Actually, if you look over 10 years, nearing a doubling on both of those measures, and actually it'd be nice to have a color graph and actually maybe extend this back further into history and project it some into the future with the information we have as well to develop this more. But Madam Chair, I'd be interested in having a deeper discussion about this again in the future.
Very well. Any comments on the chart? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just wondering if this 2011 figure includes the debt that was agreed upon in the final agreement that includes the securitization of the tobacco bonds. Is that why that figure is so high?
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair. Representative, I do not believe it does. The information came from the state's 2011, audited financial statements, and so that would have been through fiscal at the end of end of June. So I wouldn't have included that.
We will certainly bring this to Representative Howes, Chair Howes, and hopefully have further discussion on it. With that, folks, we are adjourned.